you told us only through you could we know God. And if we dared to question, he wouldn't spare the rod. For you we worked the soil, for you we dug the moors, for you we shed our blood and fought so many pointless wars. Now you try to tell us there's nothing we can do. You say the world around us belongs fairly to the few, but about 6 billion people no doubt will agree this world is our home, not your property. It's the commons, our right of birth. And you who would enclose the land all around the earth, our future is your downfall when we cut this ball and chain. You who've sacrificed the public good for your private gain. With our sweat we built the railroads, built cities on these shores. But because you own the money, you say that it's all yours. We laid the phone lines and the pipelines, and then right before our eyes, you say these things are taxes paid for. You now will privatize. Privatize the hospitals, privatize the schools, privatize the prisons for all those who break your rules. And preparing for the day when all the wells run dry, you say you own the very rain that falls down from the sky. But it's the commons, our right of birth. And you who'd own the water all around the earth, our future is your downfall when they cut this ball and chain. You who'd sacrifice the public good for your private gain. You claim to own the harvest with your Terminator seeds. You claim to own the genomes of every animal that breeds. You claim to own our culture and the music that we play. And with each song that we download to your coffers we must pay. You'd even own my name and you'd say it's for the best. Maybe you'll let us on your radio if our songs can pass your test. You own country, you own Western, you say you've given us a choice. You may own the airwaves, but you'll never own my voice. It's the commons, our right of birth. And you who'd own the music all around the earth.
Good afternoon and welcome to Corporations and Democracy for July 18th, 2024. This is the program that examines how corporations dominate our democracy and what citizens are doing to replace corporate dominance with true democracy. I'm Steve Scalmanini with co-host Annie Esposito. In today's program, we'll be discussing two separate topics in the first half hour and then for the second. And in the second half hour, we'll be discussing how democracy is doing 4 months before the November general election. And that's with Jessica Corbett. It'll be an update from a talk with her last December. She's with Common Dreams. And the first half hour, we're going to discuss a new report called the Supreme Court versus, or the topic of the Supreme Court versus working people, with Molly Coleman. Molly is the executive director of the People's Parity Project. That's a network of attorneys and law students organizing for a democratized legal system which values people over profits and builds the power of working people in the civil legal system. So a new report from that organization, the People's Parity Project, is titled Protecting Workers' Rights and Democracy from the Courts, a Practical Guide to Court Reform. Its author is a labor attorney, Jenny Hunter, and it lays out the history of the Supreme Court's negative impacts on working people and how U.S. federal courts pose an urgent threat to economic justice and worker power. So let's have a look at the Supreme Court versus working people. Molly Coleman, welcome to Corporations and Democracy.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yes, thank you so much. The People's Parity Project, which you head up, has, as Steve just mentioned, published a new report on the urgent threat the Supreme Court poses to regular working people. And I guess you're part of a chapters of lawyers around the country that are kind of worried about the direction that the Supreme Court is going, and I think a lot of people are agreeing with you right now. How did you start to put this together? How did you do this?
Yeah, so the People's Parity Project is an organization that's been around for just over 6 years now, and we were founded and grew out of the belief that lawyers and law students have a responsibility to take accountability for the legal system that lawyers, our peers, our colleagues have built. And when you look at the legal system as it currently exists, I think anybody can see quite clearly that it is not working for working people. It is working for the powerful. It is working for the rich. It's working for corporate America. But if you are an everyday worker or consumer, this system is not working. That's been true throughout the better part of American history, and it is certainly true right now. So we attempt to tackle this issue in a whole variety of ways. As you mentioned, Annie, we have chapters around the country, lawyers' chapters, law student chapters, but we also are trying to change the conversation throughout the public writ large and really trying to draw attention to the crisis that is the current Supreme Court and the power of the courts in general. So as we have looked at this current Supreme Court term and looked at the options for court reform, both today, tomorrow, and, you know, over the next 2, 5, 10, 20 years, we turned to a couple of different questions that had really been nagging at us. First, you know, why don't we tell this story of the court's impact on working people often enough and loudly enough? We, I think, have done a good job of telling the story of the court's threat to reproductive justice, to voting rights. But I think we're behind the ball on really explaining to the American public what a threat the court poses to workers and to economic justice. So we were grappling with that. And we were also looking at the reform landscape as it currently stands. And while many important court reform proposals have been put on the table, have been taken up by Congress, we felt that there were a significant set of proposals that weren't getting the attention that they deserved. So as we kind of grappled with those two questions, we came to the conclusion that the best thing we could do at this moment was to compile a comprehensive report looking at both the impact of the court on worker power and our options for reform. That led us to our work with Jenny Hunter, who, as you all identified, is a longtime labor lawyer, a writer, just a really incredible thinker on these issues. And she ultimately produced the report that we'll be talking about today and that we published just right at the end of the Supreme Court term earlier this month.
I think our listeners are probably really familiar with the things that you just mentioned that we're familiar about, the corporate excesses that the Supreme Court allows. What are some of the attacks on workers that you are worrying about?
Oh, how long do we have?
Before we take phone calls, about 12, 13 minutes.
I'll start with a case that received relatively little attention this last Supreme Court term, a case that was decided just last month, Starbucks v. McKinney. It wasn't one of the more high-profile cases. It was actually close to a unanimous case. And yet what it did is it chipped away at the power of the National Labor Relations Board to enforce labor law. It made it easier for corporations like Starbucks to get away with illegally firing workers for organizing. And what's, you know, there's so much that's interesting about that case, but part of what stands out to me is how little attention it got. And I think that's because it's so par for the course with this Supreme Court that we're going to get bad decisions for workers. We just expect that at this point. It doesn't make headlines. It's a Monday at the court. And I think that this Starbucks v. McKinney case is so emblematic of the court's long history of standing on the side of corporations against working people. So, you know, you can go back, and as the history that we trace in this report shows, you can go back to the late 1800s when unions were starting to gain strength, when workers were joining unions in significant numbers. And what was one of the most significant impediments to their ability to do that? Well, it was the federal courts generally and the Supreme Court specifically. In the 50 years leading up to 1935, courts issued 4,000 injunctions against strikes, picketing and collective action by workers. They imprisoned labor leaders. They struck down hundreds of worker protective laws. And that was just in 50 years, right? Wow. And in recent years, we've seen the court attack public sector unions in Janus v. AFSCME. We've seen them attack the ability for union organizers to meet workers where they are in a case just a couple of years back. It's really the multifaceted attack on worker power is... it's hard to overstate how dramatic the impacts of this court's attack on working people have been. And I think it really, I guess the last point I would make there is we often talk about the role of the Supreme Court as being to protect minority rights. But if you look at the court's history, the minority right that it's protecting is the right of bosses, the rights of corporations, the rights of the rich and powerful. They aren't standing with workers. They're standing with the people who would oppress workers over and over and over again.
That's a good picture for us to bear in mind when we think about the court. One of the things about the Starbucks things that really shocked me is our progressive block of three judges fell apart, and there was only the most recently appointed one. There was only one person that stood up. Wow.
It's really, it's so disheartening. And I think it really goes to show that the corporate capture of the courts isn't, it's not just Republican judges and justices who haven't stood up for workers when appointed to the bench. It's frankly, it's a bipartisan problem. And I think we need to recognize that both Democrats and Republicans have responsibility for the current state of affairs.
So you've done a lot of work, too, on, all right, so what do we do about this? And, again, I guess a lot of people have heard about the idea of court expansion, but you have identified quite a number of cures, and I guess you're thinking that we need to do all of them, not just from, we have to surround the court, I guess. Where would you start, or where have you started?
So we definitely do take, it's sort of the number one rule of improv, right? It's the yes and approach. Court reform. It's got to be yes and. And part of that is because there is no one problem. When we're talking about the courts, you can't identify a single problem, and therefore you can't have one single magic bullet that will fix it all. In the report, we identify kind of two buckets of problems. The first is that the current Supreme Court is acting as a partisan policymaker that is amassing an ever-growing amount of power to itself. The second is almost a more fundamental problem, that our current system of strong judicial review is fundamentally anti-democratic and has been used to enhance inequality and hinder the fight for progress at every turn. So as we think about those two buckets of problems, we propose a whole host of solutions. One of them, and certainly an important early step, is, as you mentioned, court expansion. Right now, we have a Supreme Court that is fundamentally illegitimate, that is so out of step with the mainstream of public consensus around policy issues, constitutional issues. We need to start by rebalancing the bench, and that has to include court expansion. We've long supported expanding the court to 13 justices. And, you know, we could talk about kind of the history of these different reforms, but I will say that is a well-established, clearly constitutional reform that Congress could enact tomorrow. We also support term limits. We support a strong code of ethics for the Supreme Court justices. But what we try to highlight in this report is, like I said, some of those reforms that maybe aren't getting as much airtime as we think they should be. And those are focused on reforms that shift the balance of power away from the Supreme Court, away from the federal courts, and back into the hands of Congress, the branch of government closest to the people and most democratically accountable, which is where we think that in a democracy, power should lie. So those reforms include things, and again, happy to talk more about what any of these would look like, but they include jurisdiction stripping, jurisdiction channeling, so either saying courts don't get to review the specific law passed by Congress, or only certain courts, either currently existing or newly established, get to review the given law. We call for supermajority requirements, so saying that you can't have a federal law struck down by a bare majority of Supreme Court justices. Mm-hmm. If you're going to strike down a law, it has to be by 6, 7, 8, or even all of the sitting justices. We also call for the enactment of fast-track congressional review, so giving Congress a mechanism to quickly and easily respond to Supreme Court decisions that don't align with the congressional intent when they pass the legislation at issue. Mm-hmm. So those are a few of the reforms we talk about in this report. I think that there's a whole host of reforms we don't get into. There are some that go beyond court reform specifically and look at, you know, ways of making the Constitution easier to amend in a way that would take power away from the Supreme Court. But that's where we tried to focus our energy here.
Let me clear up that I believe, please confirm for me, that all of those possible actions are fully legal, are they not? They're simply, they would be counters to what jurisdiction that the court claimed back in, I think it was the early 1800s, when was it John Marshall was the, you know, claimed that power for the Supreme Court, and Congress didn't act. So he you know, the court subsumed that power by default. Congress has never had the guts to change that, but it's all possible, is it not?
You're speaking my language. I think that the fact that Congress has refused to act and refused to claim its power is the core problem here. You know, the court is going to take as much power as it can. It's up to Congress to check it. But yeah, we firmly believe that every single reform that we propose in this report, every single reform that we advocate for, is fully constitutional under kind of best interpretations of the Constitution as they currently exist. I'll be honest, John Roberts, Clarence Thomas, Brett Kavanaugh, Sam Alito, Amy Coney Barrett, mm-hmm. conservatives on the Supreme Court, Neil Gorsuch, they might not agree with us. And I do think that that's why many of these reforms have as a prerequisite court expansion, because when you have a Supreme Court that is operating as the policymaking arm of the Republican Party, mm-hmm. they're unlikely to uphold many, even any, of what we would argue are very clearly constitutional reforms. So that is a major hurdle, and I don't think that we need to sugarcoat that. But, you know, if you look at the history, the size of the court has been changed by statute 7 times. There have been thousands of laws over the course of U.S. history that have either stripped jurisdiction or channeled jurisdiction. We have states that have demonstrated that a supermajority requirement is completely possible, states like North Dakota, Ohio, Nebraska. So, you know, we didn't pull anything out of thin air in writing this report.
That's news to me, by the way. And perhaps news to many listeners. So there are some states that require a supermajority on their state Supreme Courts to do something. I mean, is there a certain categories of law or anything that they must require a supermajority?
Yeah, so there both are and there have been. So not every state has maintained that supermajority requirement over time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a whole host of different ways that this could play out. You could have a supermajority requirement for certain acts. You could have a supermajority requirement passed that would apply to any constitutional decisions made by this court. There are a lot of different ways to play with these reforms and kind of subsets of the reforms that we propose, again, all of which we think would be very clearly constitutional. The other thing that I wanted to quickly mention is you talked about the early 1800s and kind of the initial Supreme Court power grab. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's a really important point to drive home, that the power that the court has given itself to be the ultimate ruler, the sole ruler on the constitutionality of federal legislation, that's a power that is not found in the Constitution. It's not a power that the framers gave to the court. It's a power that the court took for itself in 1803 and has used to the detriment of the American public time and time again in the years since.
Let me say something about the supermajority. We already got that. And they're passing all kinds of things that are terrible for most Americans by a supermajority. Is there some way to address the problem of how they get appointed in the first place, which has been pretty weaselly?
To say the least. Yeah. So a couple of things. You know, one proposal that would address how justices are appointed, both, you know, kind of in perpetuity, would be a term limits mm-hmm. legislation. So kind of the most popular proposals that have been floating around would limit every justice to an 18-year term, and it would ensure that each president has two appointments to the Supreme Court per term. So that would standardize the process. It would leave less to luck. You know, right now you can have a president like Donald Trump, who had three Supreme Court appointments in his first term. And then you can have a Joe Biden who had one appointment in his first term. Mm-hmm. So right now we leave so much to either chance or political maneuverings by the Supreme Court justices, by Republicans in the Senate. But you can imagine a system very easily, and certainly other countries utilize a system that allows for more regularity and less manipulation of the process. I will also say, you know, we've seen that Republicans in the Senate are ready and willing to play hardball at every opportunity when it comes to judicial appointments, certainly to Supreme Court appointments. You know, we talk about the number of times that the size of the court has been changed by statute, but Republicans in the Senate changed the size of the court in 2016. They didn't pass a law to do it. They just said we would rather have an eight-seat Supreme Court than allow the sitting president to fill this seat. We want to keep it open after Justice Scalia died. And so they did it. And right now you have only one party that is willing to play hardball in that way. And as a result, we have this wildly undemocratic, wildly out of step with popular opinion, Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm. You just said important words that have occurred to me in the past. There's only one party willing to play that level of hardball. Well, that's how we got into this mess.
So these cures seem pretty ponderous, but the good news is you think it's all doable.
I really do. And there are a couple of things that give me hope, something that is in rather short supply these days, but I actually do have a lot of hope that we're right on the precipice of big changes. The first is that the American people want change. A poll came out from Fox 2 days ago that found that 60% of the American public disapproves of the current Supreme Court. Only 38% approves. I mean, those are staggering numbers. And I think they show that the people see what's going on at the high court and they don't like it. And again, we live in a democracy. And even as our democracy has been twisted and distorted by the Supreme Court, by corporate power, it still matters that the people want change. And so I think that that is one thing that is giving me a lot of hope. I will also say we saw earlier this week that Joe Biden came out and said that he will be announcing support for significant court reform in the coming weeks. Mm-hmm. That matters. That is a big shift mm-hmm. from where Joe Biden was even a year ago. The fact that we expect that he will be coming out for both an enforceable code of ethics and term limits for Supreme Court justices, it shows that the ground is shifting on this really quickly and that the fact that the people want change actually is having some impact. Mm-hmm. You know, and the last thing I will say that on kind of why I think these reforms are possible is that the Supreme Court is making them more and more possible every single day. When they issue decisions like the ones that we've seen in the last month, when they flout ethical requirements, ethical standards, when they jet around with billionaires and then decide cases giving those billionaires more power in our legal system, the people see what's happening. And frankly, the Supreme Court justices are making the case for us. I don't need to be here doing what I'm doing right now. Clarence Thomas and Sam Alito are making the argument far better than I ever could that we need big structural reform right now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. There's a saying from a songwriter. Some people you don't have to quote, or you don't have to satirize. You just quote them, and what they've said speaks for itself. To listeners, we're speaking with Molly Coleman. We're talking about the new report that's out from the People's Parity Project called "Protecting Workers' Rights and Democracy from the Courts: A Practical Guide to Court Reform." And we do have time for a call or two if you'd like to call in here. By the way, we will not be auctioning off a $100,000 motorhome to the first Supreme Court justice who calls into the program today.
But
we will be taking your calls. And the number here, 895-2448, and area code 707. Again, 895-2448.
And actually, we have very little time. We have 5 minutes left, and then we're going to go on to our ace journalist is waiting here for us, Jessica Corbett. She'll be coming up next. But one thing about this report that you just put out, Molly, that's intriguing is that you really are trying to change the way people think of the court altogether, that it's not a bunch of legal stuff, that it's an economic justice question.
Yeah. I went to law school. I run an organization filled with lawyers and law students, and I think that lawyers and the legal profession have done immense harm to our democracy by acting as if you have to have a law degree to understand what this court is doing and what the implications are. We have really made it so that people are disempowered to engage with what the courts look like, what they're doing, what they should be doing, what they should look like. We've made it into, I think lawyers are very quick to make this into an academic exercise, to talk about the court as an untouchable institution filled with, you know, 9 demigods from on high. And that has, I think, prevented people from being as angry as they should be about the court and really understanding what the court is doing. Okay. So part of what we're trying to do at the People's Parity Project is to change that narrative and to say the court is the branch just like the executive branch, mm-hmm. just like the legislative branch. Their decisions have an impact on what your workplace looks like, what your rights in that workplace look like, how you are able to earn an income and build a future for your family. And it should be understood as a branch of government that the American people get to shape and should shape, and in fact have an obligation to be thinking about what we want this branch to look like and what we want it to be doing.
Let's take our first call here. We have two callers in the line. Let's take the first one. Call, you're live on the air. Would you have a question or comment for our guest?
Yes, my question is a constitutional amendment required in order to change lifetime appointments to term limits?
That's a great question. So I will say of the reforms that we've proposed in this report, this one is certainly I think that well-intentioned people on kind of all ends of the ideological spectrum can disagree on this. We firmly believe that it is constitutional, and there are a number of constitutional scholars who have done quite good work on this to show that under a fair interpretation of the Constitution, that term limits are entirely constitutional. There are some minutia that we could get into, that it's not 18 years and then you're off into retirement. There's a senior judge component to this. There's some shuffling of justices and their roles that would have to happen, or that many argue would have to happen. But yes, we believe that this can be done, and following the guidance of legal scholars, we believe that this can be done sans constitutional amendment. And certainly, frankly, wouldn't be proposing anything that we thought needed a constitutional amendment to be enacted, because this country has made amending the Constitution simply impossible. And we don't think that that's a viable path forward at this point.
Okay.
Yeah,
and I'd like to.
Neither do I. Yeah. But I've read that the Constitution says that justices of the Supreme Court are appointed for life. So wouldn't it require an amendment to change that?
So So
I don't believe it says that, actually, but go ahead, please.
I think you got the answer. It's a little complicated. There are great legal minds that disagree on that point, apparently.
Okay. Thank you. I'm going to continue listening.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for calling. Our second caller seemed to have dropped off.
We only have 1 minute left anyway, so maybe we don't really have time for another question, and maybe give Jessica, oh, here comes another call. Should we take that or just give Jessica the time, Molly, time for the last word, and we have Jessica up next to talk about.
Okay, I'm okay with one call. It has to be super quick.
Okay.
Caller, can you be super quick with your question or comment?
Yes, I can. I want to know why it is that the 13 original colonies got 2 senators apiece. So that's 26 out of 100. And California has 2 senators for the entire state with how many millions of people?
Well, that's
There's an inherent... And also, how much money is... What's the percentage of money that's spent on justices and bailiffs and prisons and mental health? You know, it's like the law is not equal. It's
all
not
right.
equal.
Well, true indeed. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
And the answer is a different topic for a different day. I mean, that's something else in the original Constitution, which is beyond just the Supreme Court issue. So
another thing to fret about.
Yeah. So, okay, well, to Molly Coleman, and thank you very much. She's with the People's Parity Project, and you can read more. You can read the actual report itself, 45 pages or something like that, at the website, peoplesparity.org. And thanks for being with us and taking that one question from one caller.
Yes, thank you so much. Thanks for doing that report. It's amazing.
Okay, bye-bye. Hey, I wanted to play a few seconds of our theme music in between the two halves of the program, but it's not coming through. So we will progress with what we have here. Our guest for the second half of the program is a familiar name, was with us about, I think it was 7 months ago, Jessica Corbett from Common Dreams. I'm going through my outline here with a few blank pages on it, if you want. Fumbling here is, you know. But our second guest is journalist Jessica Corbett. She's a staff writer and senior editor for Common Dreams and a favorite of ours to assess news on the national and global scale. She was with us again last December. And we have an opportunity today to have a look at, well, how's democracy doing now, 7 months after our last talk, and 4 months before the general election? So, Jessica Corbett, welcome to Corporations and Democracy.
Thank you for having me back.
Yes, thank you so much. We follow you on Common Dreams and are amazed at the scope of things that you cover. And I thought maybe before we talk about some of the craziness that you write about every day, could you talk a little bit about how do you navigate all this conflicting, contradicting stuff that's coming at us from all sides? Most of my friends are feeling just anxiety-ridden over this.
Yeah, well, I think especially given the kind of overwhelming amount of information that people are hit with and advances in technology, including artificial intelligence, we're seeing a lot of misinformation spread not only on social media, but sometimes picked up by news sites, not necessarily always maliciously. And so I think it is a very scary time for communication and information. And a lot of folks across journalism are struggling to deal with it, you know, especially as things like deep fakes, which are like videos that are convincing, kind of start to proliferate online. And so for us, we are certainly very mindful of trying to verify every single detail that goes into a story. For me personally, I come from a fact-checking background, so I started off in professional journalism, actually fact-checking for places like In These Times and The Nation, and I feel like that really gave me a solid foundation for kind of vetting information and processing it quickly, and it kind of just builds your instinct for recognizing things that seem dubious. And, you know, I think the other thing is having lived through the first Trump administration, administration. As the Washington Post documented, I think perhaps shortly after, and certainly during Trump's first term, he told over 30,000 lies while he was president.
That's impressive.
Having to contend with that every day, I think really trained me well. I don't know that we've learned, as a media, some important lessons about appropriately challenging that misinformation. But I think it's becoming increasingly important as we head into another presidential election.
Well, when you come out with your handbook on how to deal with the news, we'll have you on to talk about that. One of the things that you've written about recently, of course, is peripheral to the Republican National Convention, and they made a big splash with how pro-labor the Republicans have suddenly become. And so you've written a couple things, talk to people about that. How do you know whether the Republicans are pro-worker or not when they have the head of the Teamsters on there? Doesn't that show that they are?
Well, I think that's a great example of pushing back against, or the importance of pushing back against, the political messaging regardless of the party. Historically, the Republican Party has not been pro-worker, and the Economic Policy Institute, for example, put out a report today, and it was not partisan in nature, but it was actually looking at regions, and it said, policymakers in the U.S. South, in particular, over the last four decades, have pushed policies that have really harmed workers. And when you look at who's controlled the state houses and the governor's mansions in the South for the last 40 years, it's predominantly Republicans. And one of the recommendations after Sean O'Brien, the Teamsters president, spoke at the RNC earlier this week was, okay, if Republicans want to claim that they are pro-worker, then hold a vote in Congress when lawmakers return to Capitol Hill next week and vote on the PRO Act, which would make it easier for workers across the country to organize and institute a lot of labor reforms that that workers and labor groups have been pushing for a long time. But of course, if they did that, we would see similar, I think, to some of the reproductive rights votes that we've seen in the Senate over the last couple of months. Republicans aren't actually interested predominantly in passing that. I think there are a handful of Republicans in the House who do support the PRO Act, but it's very, very few, I think maybe three of them, whereas you've got vast support across the Democratic Party, which is quite diverse in a variety of issues, but on the labor front, for the most part, they all support the PRO Act.
So the PRO Act is protecting the right to organize, and so that workers vote for a union all the time, but they never end up getting a contract, right? So that's one of your litmus tests, is that you would see how they vote on actually protecting a worker's right to unionize, and that gives you a better idea of. You just mentioned.
Yeah.
Oh, go ahead.
The other thing is that the Republicans control the House, so you're not going to see that happen in the House of Representatives. But I think the proposal is one that gives a clear indication of where they actually come down on this issue.
Okay, so you mentioned the abortion rights that are under attack. One of the things that I noticed from the Things in Common Dreams that you've been both writing and editing, there's enormous continuous flow of these bills, these anti-abortion bills. They just never stop. There was one again this week, and then three more recently affirming the right to cross state lines for abortions, and that was, I guess, torpedoed. Do you want to talk about this as a whole kind of an ongoing thing, an everyday thing?
Yeah, so one of the beauties of Democrats controlling the Senate is that even though they haven't been able to do much because of the filibuster and the fact that it's so split, they have been at least able to hold these kind of show votes, which the Republicans have thrown tantrums about. But Democrats have pointed to, you know, especially during an election year, during which we're not only going to be deciding the presidency, but also control of Congress, holding votes on abortion rights, as well as birth control and IVF. And in all three of those cases, the Republicans blocked the bills from advancing to a final vote. I think in the case of the abortion rights bill, maybe Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski did, you know, stand with the Democrats. But on the whole, you've got the Republican senators opposing these reproductive freedom bills, and yet not mentioning abortion or reproductive freedom at the RNC, because I think they do recognize that there is a political unpopularity. You know, they recognize that it's a threat, and so they're trying to bury their very key role in stripping away the rights of people to control their bodies.
That's a little crazy how they're very two-sided here. They don't mention it when there's a lot of people paying attention, and meanwhile, to keep their base happy, then they're running this stuff through the legal system all the time. It's pretty amazing. So I imagine you have a story on abortions just about every week. One of the things that people have been talking a lot about is the Republicans Project 2025 and all the kind of fascist things that lurk in there. But you've also been looking at the Democrats' response to that. The Democrats are also looking at things that they are aspirational for 2025 that would be way more Democratic, small d. What have you been seeing that the Democrats are going to bring to us in 2025 so we can stop being terrified?
Well, I think there are pushes with the Democratic Party to try and safeguard reproductive freedom at the national level. There's been, you know, long-time efforts among Democrats in Congress to pass the voting rights legislation at the national level. And so I think those are some of the things that are very popular among the public. And if Democrats were able to control the White House and control both houses of Congress, that they would prioritize. I think also climate is a big priority. You know, certainly on one hand, Biden has received some criticism for his climate record, and yet also passed the Inflation Reduction Act, or signed the Inflation Reduction Act, which, while watered down from what was initially envisioned by some progressives in Congress, was still a landmark climate bill just in terms of U.S. history.
And I guess also Biden is supposed to propose a 5% cap on annual rent increases?
Yeah, so two of the other big things that we've seen this week are the cap on rent increases, and that would have to go through Congress because the way they envision it involves taxation. But I think that, you know, shows that there's an attentiveness to the need to address some of the price gouging that we've seen from landlords, because this would target major landlords, not like the small mom and pop folks who have like one building or a couple of units. Like, this is targeting the major landlords who are ripping off renters across the country. And then the other thing that we're seeing, which I know you guys have touched on, is the Biden's push for changing the policies of the Supreme Court. And I think that is also a major priority. And as the previous guest said, you know, the right-wing justices are kind of making the case for that. Democrats don't even really need to push for it all that hard if they can manage to win these upcoming elections, because anyone who's paid attention to anything done by Clarence Thomas or Samuel Alito in recent months can see clearly the argument for actually having some ethics policies that are enforceable.
Speaking of the Supreme Court again, everybody, I think, was shocked at the dismissal of the classified documents case against Trump, because that was one of the most clear cases and one of the most egregious. I mean, as far as I know, there were, you know, agents around the world that were murdered when they were exposed by somehow documents getting out. Could it be the same documents? What have you been finding out about that particular case?
Yeah, so I wrote about this earlier in the week, shortly after it happened. The judge who dismissed the case and who has been overseeing that case is a district judge in Florida. Her name is Eileen Cannon, and she was actually appointed by Trump while he was in office. So I think that it's not really a surprise, based on her previous decisions, that this happened. Clarence Thomas really opened up the floodgates for this with his concurrence in the presidential immunity case recently before the High Court. And so I think we should have anticipated that this was going to happen as soon as he included kind of a suggestion for that in his concurring opinion. Mm. And I think we'll see that it's going to be appealed, and whether the appeals court brings it back remains to be seen. But this is going to reach the Supreme Court, if I had to guess. And, you know, given the Supreme Court's history of siding with Trump, I think we should be concerned about, about it. And either way, I mean, the point is they're delaying the case. And the chances of this getting decided before the November presidential election seem very slim. And I think that really is a high priority of Trump, because if he becomes president again, then he's like, oh, well, don't need to worry about it anymore. And if he doesn't, then, you know, maybe he'll flee to a foreign country, jump on his private jet, and try not to face any accountability.
There was a bit of a shock doctrine aspect to this, too, because a judge came up with this outrageous dismissal the day after an attempted assassination of Trump, and I assume she was believing everybody would be distracted.
Oh, yeah, I think that that's definitely possible.
Change topic a little bit. What is your take from your view on the issue of election integrity and the validity of the upcoming election?
You know, I think that what scares me more is less whether the ballots are being counted accurately, and more some of the intimidation that we might see at the polls. Mm-hmm. And this is something that we've written about for months and months. But I think, given, you know, we have seen from particularly Trump supporters a willingness to break into the Capitol and disrupt an official proceeding, that it won't be a shock to see people trying to show up at polling stations with AR-15s, or to try and intimidate people who are just trying to participate in the election. So that, where that is on my mind, way more than having any kind of concerns about whether the ballots are counted correctly. I think that, you know, for the most part, election officials are well-meaning in doing their job. That's not always the case. You know, we have folks who have ill intentions, who have been trying to seek those kind of offices. Mm-hmm. But I think that my fear is more what conflicts we might see at polling stations and in the lead up to the election.
Yeah, there has been references to, you know, challenging voters. That's going to be a hot topic in Georgia. Yeah. And then I'm not sure what other states, but there will be some other states. And by the way, we hope to have either next month or the one after, hope to have here on our program Greg Palast to talk about that.
Okay.
He's on top of that issue. He certainly mm-hmm. is and was for Georgia in the last election. And the issues that he exposed about voter challenging is going to be expanded to other states. So that's a concern we'll be following here.
Yeah, he's coming up with a new movie, right? So you can check out his website, Palast, Greg Palast, if you want to see what his latest is. I wonder, should we talk a little bit about war, which is going on all around us, and yet it seems to be ignored in some really strange ways? You did something about the airstrikes in Yemen that are going on continuously, and nobody seems to worry about it as much as they should be worrying about it.
Yeah, so recently there was an anti-war coalition, actually quite diverse in ideology, but over 50 groups wrote to a bipartisan group of senators who earlier this year had expressed frustration toward the White House with airstrikes in Yemen and the Red Sea, particularly since Congress under the Constitution has the power to declare war and has not declared war on Yemen. And so In this letter, the basic demand of these groups was that the senators would bring forward a war powers resolution that would end any what they call illegal and ineffective U.S. airstrikes in Yemen. And I think that that is a great example of the fact that I think conflict in general kind of takes a backseat as soon as something else comes along. You know, we saw a lot of Gaza coverage, for example, and then Trump almost gets assassinated, and that is suddenly off the front pages of the major U.S. newspapers, even as the death toll in Gaza continues to get ramped up. And in that case, you know, Israel has been enabled both in terms of political support and weapons support from the Biden administration, from the Congress.
Yeah, indeed. I should mention this. Some listeners know our own congressman is on both sides of that issue because he has he's opposed to or he's supportive of a peace deal in Gaza, but he is not opposed to sending cluster bombs to Israel to use in Gaza. So we have an issue there locally to be dealt with.
That's just another story that you've done, Jessica. And this one got me. The State Department report on genocide, I guess they're supposed to do a report every year on genocide in the world. And so what happened this with the current report? There was sort of selective genocides?
Yeah, so the report itself does mention Israel and Gaza, but it is a three-paragraph section that stresses the quote, Israel has an inherent right to defend itself, which is in line with what we expect from, I think, the State Department and the Biden administration on this issue. They have not backed down, even when criticizing the Israeli forces killing of civilians in Gaza. They have not backed down from trying to justify this war that is now being investigated at the International Court of Justice as genocide, increasingly condemned as such on a global scale. So that was very much the tenor of the three paragraphs in which this congressionally mandated report discussed Israel and Gaza. And in the press release that they put out, it didn't actually mention Israel and Gaza at all. And, you know, one of the experts that I quoted said, I guess they left out the genocide, their arming and funding, which I think really kind of summed up the general sentiment of the State Department, not necessarily the individuals at the State Department. We've seen some internal anger at the administration. We've seen resignations from that department and across the administration in protest of U.S. support for the war. So I think that, you know, certainly there is a range of opinions among government workers and officials, but in terms of which opinions actually make it to the official reports and statements, I think that's very clearly in line with the administration's position.
Let me mention that there's the opportunity to call in and ask a question or comment to Jessica Corbett, our guest, senior editor and a staff writer at Common Dreams. And the number here is 895-2448. That's in 707, of course, 895-2448.
And our ace journalist, Jessica Corbett, she's writes for Common Dreams, and she also edits a lot of the other material that her colleagues turn in, so she has a handle on about everything and is a professional fact checker, which is what we really need right now when we're talking about the news. The other big category that Common Dreams does a lot on, and it's maybe the most important one, is the environment. So there's been a lot going on with big oil lately, and there was a study that came out of England that was a funny name, an influence map. What is an influence map analysis?
So Influence Map is an organization. And so they recently put out a report about big oil lobbying And they specifically looked at the American Petroleum Institute and then its kind of peer organizations in Europe and the UK, and the way that they've played a key role in pushing against the clean energy transition. So even when you've got big oil coming out and trying to claim that they are participating in the solution and want to help solve the energy and climate crisis that they created, you have these trade organizations that are very clearly kind of doing their dirty work and continue to do so.
I like the three little poles they have: solution skepticism, policy neutrality, and affordability, or downplaying alternatives. Policy neutrality. They have a kind of affordability. They try to make it look like going green would be way too expensive or way too risky. What is the solution skepticism?
So that is downplaying the impact or the viability of alternative energy. So casting doubt on the effectiveness of things like solar and wind power, which we know that we could be using with battery storage to derive a great amount of power from. But there's all kinds of misinformation and in the service of pushing things like natural gas instead, because these companies have a bunch of existing assets that they're afraid to lose.
I should mention a headline from just a couple of days ago of interest to listeners, since we're here in California. And the headline was that the California grid did not go down during the heat wave of a week and a half, pushing 2 weeks that we had out here. And the subtitle was, thanks to all the batteries that have been put on the grid in recent years.
Because of the transition. Yeah, there you go. Now, one cool thing, we're just about out of time. We got 4 minutes, but it is of note that Puerto Rico is suing a handful of these oil giants, right?
Yeah, so this is a trend that we've seen increasing, particularly over the last 5 years or so, are these climate liability lawsuits where communities and states across the U.S. are seeking to sue companies like Shell, ExxonMobil, BP for creating a climate crisis and lying about the impact of their products for the last several decades, which we saw very clearly in, various reporting, but also a congressional investigation that recently concluded. And Puerto Rico in particular has faced these intense hurricanes that have been wildly destructive. And I think so, given that and the colonial history with the United States, there's kind of a special focus on this particular case, but it does follow in the footsteps of many other state attorneys general and local leaders who have launched similar lawsuits. Now, we haven't seen these necessarily produce any compensation to these communities yet, but I think that especially as we continue to see devastating extreme weather, that it just builds the case for making big oil pay for these damages.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we're just about out of time. I will just squeeze in there that I was really taken with the idea that there's a movement to bring criminal charges against big oil companies for deaths that are related to the climate crisis. I love that part of your article.
I'll just note that that's coming from some folks at Public Citizen and some other prosecutors and legal experts that they're working with to develop this movement.
Okay.
Super. I'm sure many of those related to the heat waves that are going on, including right now, parked over your neighborhood there in the Northeast.
Oh.
Okay, Jessica Corbett, thanks for being our guest today and for the update. And to listeners, we'll be focusing more on election issues coming up. So thanks for listening. This has been Corporations and Democracy. We will be back in a month. I think it'll be the third Thursday of August. That's August 15th. For more information about the subjects that we discuss here, you can go to www.thealliancefordemocracy.org. And thanks for listening.